Welcome everyone to today's episode of the Lindsay Elmore Show. Today, I speak with Dr. Paul Anderson about the generational shift that is occurring in the treatment of cancer. Gone are the days where the doctor knows everything and the only type of treatment course is the one that he or she prescribes. Nope. These days, patients are looking for a wide variety of treatments. And Dr. Anderson has 30 years of experience in integrative and holistic cancer treatments. Today, we talk not only about how critical it is to have a healthy diet and an exercise routine and a sleep routine, but really how mindset can affect the outcome of our treatment course. We dig deep into how to not get stuck in the process of processing a cancer diagnosis. Let's get to the show. Welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast that helps you find fulfillment amidst chaos. On this show, I interview thought leaders, doctors, creatives, spiritual gurus, and game changers who inspire you to pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. Dr. Paul Anderson is a naturopathic medical doctor who focuses on complex infectious, chronic, and oncological illnesses. He has 3 decades of clinical experience and served as the lead investigator of an NIH-funded human research trial using intravenous and integrative therapies in cancer patients. He founded Advanced Medical Therapies in Seattle, Washington, a clinic that focuses on the care of patients with cancer and chronic diseases, and now focuses on clinical collaborations with clinics and hospitals in the United States and other countries. He is the author of Outside the Box Cancer Therapies with Dr. Mark Stengler, as well as co-author of the anthology Success Breakthroughs with Jack Canfield. His latest book, Cancer, The Journey from Diagnosis to Empowerment, is about the process of dealing with a cancer diagnosis for yourself or for a loved one, and how we can become empowered even during this difficult journey. In the book, he writes that the goal is to increase the quality of life and relationships even while cancer is a part of your life. Today, he and I talk about how we can approach cancer differently and become empowered owners of our own health, even when we face what can be the most devastating of diagnoses. Dr. Paul Anderson, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thanks for having me.
You have 2 books about creating empowered patient journeys through cancer. You have a newer book called The Journey from Diagnosis to Recovery, as well as Outside the Box Cancer Therapies. Now, when people get a cancer diagnosis, it can seem like the whole world gets turned upside down, but yet cancer in many ways is not so very much different than many other chronic diseases. And so how have you begun to think about cancer differently? And what are some of the more out-of-the-box interventions that you have seen really transform patients' lives?
That's a great place to start. I think one of the things that has been transformative, at least in my world of cancer care, has been if I go back, say, 30 years to when I started till now, there's been a lot of evolution in oncology generally, and also in the area often that's described that I do is sometimes called palliative or integrative or some mixture of those sort of things. So my job is, just so people know, to orchestrate all of the things that the medical or radiation or surgical oncologist is not doing and they have very big jobs. So I like to start out by saying they're not doing anything wrong. They have extremely highly critical jobs, and their job, if they're giving you chemotherapy, is to do it in a way that does not harm you, et cetera, you know, if it's radiation, same thing. So while they are aware, and I have a lot of colleagues in those areas, while they're aware of a lot of these other things, it's not within their time scope to deal with it, even if they want to. So what people like myself do then is to step in, and I always tell people, you know, sort of like there's this sliver of the pie that you're keen. Let's say you're going to do chemo. Not everyone does, but let's say that's a common thing. You know, so that sliver is cared for by this team here, you know, at the hospital or at the oncology clinic. The whole rest of the pie has to be taken care of, but they don't have time to get much into it. So what we do is the rest. Well, literally, I'll be generous, 20 years ago, but even more recently than that, a lot of the oncology community was very suspicious of what we did in the rest of the pie. And they would say, well, we won't treat you if you go see Dr. Anderson, because we don't understand what he's doing. Most of them, it wasn't personal. It was just, they didn't understand. Well, the big shift that's happened, and I think this is really, you know, goes to what led to both of the books, is it's a little bit, you know, doctors communicating better and publishing more stuff. And I was involved in NIH research and all that business. But really, I think what drove it is patients becoming empowered, because we finally got this generational shift from the doctor is always right, you know, which, I mean, if you're a doctor, you know, wonderful, that's great to be always right, but you aren't. We shifted from that to, well, wait a minute, you're really good at this area, this piece of the pie, but you don't really know about all these other things. And so can't I get an expert in this area? And the shift that I really saw was a little bit on doctors' communication side, but really more the patients getting into it and saying, no, you are going to treat me, and we are going to work as a team, you know, with whomever to help me. And so the rest of the pie, you know, would include all sorts of things, diet, lifestyle, you know, what do you do with your, you know, exercise when you're during chemo and you don't feel well, and what, you know, all of these things. And then there's a lot of other outside the box things. So I think the biggest change has been facilitated by patients being empowered, and now oncologists are more used to having the conversation. It used to be they could just cut people off. And when I was training, you know, a million years ago, that was what doctors did. They just cut people off when they got to these uncomfortable conversations. Now people don't put up with that. So I really think the empowerment of the human in their care, it forces us doctors to listen to them. And I think that's been the biggest revolution. And then, you know, everything flows down from that, all the technical stuff.
So do you think it's more about patients learning on their own, or do you think it's because people have worked with naturopathic medical doctors such as yourself to discuss exercise and diet and all the things that can make the journey of cancer a more tolerable one, and one that is potentially even going to help increase your odds of survival? How do you think this shift began to occur, and what do you think have been the most important touch points along the way that has led people to have a greater conversation about totally integrative care during cancer?
Yeah, I think it's, of course, multifactorial. I do believe, you know, whenever you have a swing of a pendulum from, you know, sort of very restrictive to, no, we want options, there's a knowledge gap. And so a lot of it is people trying to become educated and informed, and doctors trying to become educated and informed in this big knowledge gap. And so then that creates a lot of, you know, uncomfortable situations where we don't have answers to everything. But the patient says, well, I read about this, you know, what is this, can I do this, you know, or whatever. And one of the reasons Dr. Stengel and I wrote the first book, which is much more about therapies and, you know, integrative and outside the box therapies, was to show how much science there is. But the other thing was to educate patients so they could say, you know, okay, these doctors together have done this for 50 or 60 years. If they were going to tell you to put your resources in an area and you had breast cancer or, you know, colon cancer, their top five would be here. You know, it maybe wouldn't be one of these things over here. Not that they're bad, but just this is what we see work more often. So I think it's this nice mixture of patient empowerment leading to curiosity, doctors getting sort of way more up to speed on what these things are, and then the science sort of meeting in the middle. And so I think it's been a really good time. Now, for a lot of healthcare providers, you know, quite honestly, the internet was a really shocking turn for them to have, because suddenly you get patients bringing you in, you know, maybe research studies you've never heard of in your life, right? So in the beginning, it was it caused a lot of problems for patients trying to get info. Now it's a little bit more, certainly any doctor who's been, you know, been alive or trained in the last 20 years, now at least they have a way of saying either, gee, I'll look into that, or, oh no, I read about that, but, you know, we're not really doing that. We're doing this over here, and here's the difference. So I think a lot of it is just this evolutionary change. The other thing that I saw was in the beginning of, so we're going back now about 10 years ago, there was a 5-year long National Institute of Health funded study. I was a part of it. I ran an interventional clinic, which meant IV therapy and, you know, things of that nature. And it was all, the NIH wanted to see if people who did integrative therapies with their regular therapy or just regular therapy, did one live longer or not? And later we looked at quality of life, which was better. And indeed, our patients did live longer, and we weren't, you know, counteracting anything. You know, it was a whole thing. That caused a lot of evolution in just this communication between, you know, kind of traditional oncology, et cetera. It's not like people suddenly were, you know, heaven opened and everything became easier, because in North America, of course, we have this layer called insurance that gets in the middle of everything and creates a financial strain. So, so I think that, you know, it's just been this nice collage of mostly patient empowerment and education, doctors having to get up to speed because of that, and then better communication kind of around the points of the compass.
So what are some of the integrative therapies? You know, we mentioned a tiny bit about exercise. I've heard, you know, intermittent fasting seems to be the thing now, as far as before you go in for chemotherapy. You mentioned IV therapies. Of course, IV vitamin C has been around for a very long time, multiple different antioxidant therapies. What do you think are some of the best preventatives, as well as some of the most robustly studied adjunctive therapies?
Yeah, that is, so I'm gonna really narrow it down to two groups of things.
Great, please do.
We could talk for years on this. One of the things, and this is both practical, but also it's actually a huge clinical indicator for you if you have cancer, whether you do well or not. But the practical side is I'll go around and I'll give presentations to medical students or doctors or whatever. And some people will say, well, you know, I work mostly in a welfare funded community and they don't have any money for anything, you know, extra. Well, what I learned as we were writing the first book and looking backwards at what therapies do we still do that we, because they work, what didn't, all this. What I started to see even below that was, what is it about the patient, the way they treat themselves, that creates a more receptive host, a better patient for whatever therapy they get, even surgery, right? there are three things that anyone can do that don't really cost you any more money. And if you do these things, it's like you have a firm foundation, then any other therapy works better. And what I would tell the students is, if they don't do the foundational things, you can spend $1 million on other therapies. Eventually, they're going to fall through this foundation. And it's three primary things. One is food, and that includes the cleanliness of your food, but how much you eat, when you eat, such as intermittent fasting, et cetera. And then, you know, maybe the macros of what you eat and all that. The next, and I'll get a little bit more into it, but the next one is muscle. So food and then muscle. Literally by doing nothing more than improving the activity of your skeletal muscle, the stuff that holds us up and moves us around, you have improved survival with even stage four cancers. And there's a balance. Just think of it like a seesaw, you know, a balance between fat metabolism and muscle. And so people will sort of be depressed and say, well, I'm overweight to start with. So that means, you know, that's not going to help me. No, you can start overweight, but if you just get your muscles working a little more every day, muscle metabolism tells your body, and it also tells the cancer immune, interface, we're not in the cancer business right now. We're in this, you know, pro muscle activity, et cetera. So you don't have to be a marathoner to do that. So muscle's huge. So you minimize fat activity, maximize muscle, and anybody can do that. And then the third is brain. And that is both what comes into your brain, but also how are you thinking about it? Are you feeling empowered? Are you, you know, all of that? So if we start with those things, and literally that sort of those three blocks kind of came to me when we were done writing the first book. I was looking back over and I was mentoring this clinic that I was running, and we mostly saw cancer patients, mentoring other physicians who took care of the patients. And this was the thing that I said, you know, if I look back over all this time, we've got great, cool therapies we can do, but if people aren't attending to these basics, they won't last. It's like they don't stick. And it really, really does. So food includes, you know, of course, get the least toxic food you can, you know, don't focus your calories in junk, you know, stuff grandma would have told you. Intermittent fasting, interesting thing, which was great because a human study came out right before we had to go to press with the first book. In breast cancer patients, they didn't even change their diet at all. They let them eat whatever they wanted. But they took breast cancer survivors and they put half with a 13-hour intermittent fast, which almost anyone can do because you're asleep for a big part of it and you just drink a lot of water. And then the rest of the day you can eat. The other half just ate whatever they wanted whenever. They had a third less recurrence of cancer just by doing that, not even changing their diet. So imagine, you know, if you actually changed your diet. So there's a lot of things in that area. Now, what I always tell people is the basic things like, you know, stay hydrated, eat as little, you know, junk and additives and all that as possible, have good balanced macros, a lot of veggies and stuff. Those are pretty universal. If you get into things like intermittent fasting or doing other things in that neighborhood, you really want to work with somebody where that's what they do, because there's little, you know, you and I might fast very differently, or we might tolerate it very differently, et cetera. So in the food area, there's a lot in that base that can go on. And in the muscle area, it's mostly moving. And so we've had people literally after surgery, they couldn't move much. So, you know, it was sort of raising their arms a few more times. And we've had people where, you know, they could walk to the bathroom four times a day. So we got them to take an extra trip, you know, or whatever. And literally that's enough to start. Now, of course, if you have more capacity, you can do more. And the whole brain thing is why I wrote the second book about empowerment, because it's this two-way street of, there's two things I saw happen with patients. One is they internally would just get so defeated because nobody wants to hear they have cancer. And you have to process it. You know, and a lot of us North Americans are not great at processing. We like to suppress everything. So there's a process you go through to process it. but there's also the external inputs, you know, whether it's, you know, your negative neighbor or the news you watch all the time or your partner, you know, or whatever. You have to protect yourself from what's going in, but you also have to empower, you know, you and what's going around. And then the most important part there is it's fine to be upset about your diagnosis because that's part of processing. It's just you don't want to stay upset because that's not a healthy thing. So those are the bases. Things beyond that. So if you look at Mark Stengler in my first book, we wrote it together. We have, I think, one shy of 1,100 scientific references. It's referenced like a textbook. The reason we did that is most patients would go to their oncologist and they'd say, I've never heard of this. There must be no science on it. And so this way the oncologist can actually, and they do, it's actually been great for communication. So what we tried to do in there was prioritize, you know, if you're going to go now beyond the base and spend some of your money on a, you know, non-covered service or something, here's things we would think about. So there's the base. Depending on the type of cancer, there's a lot of really a lot of research on medicinal mushrooms. Some people have heard of, say, shiitake or maitake and some of the Chinese blends.
My brain went to the other medicinal mushrooms. I went straight to the psilocybin. Okay, different ones.
I've been talking about mushrooms for so long, and that discussion was always sort of the one you didn't have. Now, when I say medicinal mushrooms, I have to qualify. It's both now, but we would start with the immunomodulatory ones, and then there's...
Okay, the reishi mushrooms of the world. I've got you. Okay.
Once you eat, and yeah, and then there's the other kind. But actually, as far as, like, you know, let's say, you know, it was my brother, and they said, okay, I'll do your basics. I can afford one supplemental thing. You know, I'd probably heavily consider some of the medicinal mushroom type things. And that's not to say there's not like a lot of other things. There's a lot of really specific therapies that we do. But what you want to look at is there's a number of sides of tumor biology, of cancer problems. One side is the tumor you see and are dealing with. So a solid tumor, be say like a breast or liver cancer. Then there's like hematologic blood tumors like leukemias and that sort of thing where they're more all over. But the tumor you see are the now foreign cells. Then there's what they're doing to the rest of your body. And so the way I would talk to patients, I'd say, I'm almost more interested in all this part of you, which is most of you that doesn't have cancer, as I am in this cancer that's going on. And the important part of that is that the way cancer wins often, there's a number of ways, but one of the big ways is it recruits the normal parts of you over to being more cancer-like or cancer-like. So when you see that, you think about, well, what can I do that would be protective and also help my immune system be more vigilant? So like mushrooms fill a big role there. That's why they work so well. Vitamin C in many cases, not all, is another one. And the reason for that is not so much it's, you know, magical in its own, but humans don't make vitamin C. There's important things like glutathione. We can make our own glutathione. We can make other stuff, but vitamin C, we lost somewhere along the way the ability to make it. And it's necessary. And it's not that we always need a lot. We just need enough to kind of keep things level. And when we get sick, the levels go way down and level is gone, right? So that's why vitamin C comes up a lot. And there's differences like oral, we do differently than, you know, intravenous vitamin C, which is a big thing we were doing in the research with our patients and all that. There's a lot of other non-mushroom plant medicines that have a lot of research, and that list could go on, you know, forever. One that people mostly have heard about would be, say, curcumin. So the part of the turmeric spice that's isolated and also turmeric itself. There are other, in Chinese and certain types of Western herbal medicine, there's a plant called wormwood, which is a very, very bitter plant. That works on a number of levels, depending on whether you're looking from the Chinese perspective or the Western, but it works. It does a lot of things. It's actually, there's extracts of it that are used in autoimmunity and malaria and other things. And it's being more well studied in cancer and autoimmunity now. Part of our research, we actually used a subfraction of that that we infused into people as an IV. And we did a study where we took a group of people getting integrative breast cancer care. And a third of them wanted to do the infusion where we give them the artesanate, it's called, it's a drug for malaria. And then
that's the one that's derived from wormwood.
A third did that, and then all the integrative stuff, and the other two thirds did all the integrative stuff without the infusions. And over the 3 years we studied them, the people that got the artemisia compound, their survival was much higher. And these are stage four, the worst kind of breast cancer. So there's a lot of different type plant things. The important part is it's stratifying and making the importance appropriate. So like if there's something that can cover a lot of bases, you're better doing that and then adding on top of it. And this is where the world of integrative oncology, there is a subspecialty in the naturopathic medical world called naturopathic oncology. They're actually board certified, or other people who this is their thing. They can help you and say, look, you have a stage one or stage two breast cancer. This is a better way to put your efforts than if you have a stage four breast cancer. We might do things, you know, very differently. So it's really good to get some advice about that. And the other thing I'll say is the standard system is trying, you know, they're at least giving people handouts now about being active and, you know, other things like that. But there's not a lot of resources in the standard system that are insurance funds, unfortunately. So, that's a long answer, but it's really the shortest answer I could give at.
I am so excited to tell you, podcast family, that Thinks, your favorite period absorbing underwear, is launching activewear. That's right. As of January the 12th, 2021, you now have period protection even when you head to the gym. Now, if you've listened to the show, you know that Thinks has been absolutely life-changing for me. I'm going on over a year of only using Thinks for period protection. And now there is an activewear line that features cycle shorts, training shorts, leggings, and leotards with the signature Thinks period-absorbing layers built right in. They come in three cute colors: black, kale, and heather gray, and they come in sizes between extra small and extra large, and plus sizes are coming later on this year. That means that whatever resolutions that you have made this year, you can tackle one tiny habit at a time. Whether it's yoga, stretching, being at the gym, working out on home equipment, or simply walking down the street after a workout at the gym, you can now feel confident because each of these products is there to be used either on its own or as backup, depending on your flow. The training shorts and leotards hold up to 5 tampons worth of menstrual flow. The leggings, which I have a pair of and absolutely love, hold 3 regular tampons worth, and the cycle shorts hold up to 2 regular tampons worth. Best of all, the leggings and the cycle shorts come with heating pad pockets. So if you're working out somewhere that it's cold outside, you can simply slip in some pocket warmers to stay warm throughout your entire training session. Period active wear is here, and all of the essentials you need, no matter what kind of activity you're doing, is there to give you the protection and the comfort that you need to have an active period. If you want to get started with some of the active wear or any of the other Thinx period proof absorbing panties, go ahead and head to www.shethinx, that's shethinx.com/Lindsay Elmore, that's shethinx.com/Lindsay Elmore, to save $10 off of your first order. Your workout activity on your period has never been better. Shop now, shethinks.com/Lindsay Elmore. Well, it's interesting because when you first started talking about food, muscles, and brain, I mean, there is so much discourse about what we eat and how much we should eat and how often we should eat it. And of the same too for exercise. But when you mentioned brain, I thought we were going to go down an omega-3 fatty acid and a stopping caffeine by 4 p.m. so you can optimize sleep. But what you're saying is that what goes in is oftentimes an indicator of the healing potential. And I think many people, as you said, consider cancer a death sentence. And so when someone gets a diagnosis, what are the benefits that go beyond the wormwood infusions and beyond the intermittent fasting, where you just get down to a genuine core belief that I am not this cancer?
So yeah, very, very good distinction. So there's nothing wrong, or I would leave out about, you know, brain nutrients and, you know, sleep hygiene and all of those things that you mentioned. Very, very important, because obviously just like the rest of your body, without the right stuff going in for fuel and support, your brain's not going to work, you know. But really, yeah, when I talk about brain, it actually starts more at that core level. And so, and this is really what this and all those patient and doctor interactions where I was trying to synthesize, how do I just break this brain thing down? Because it's so, maybe not easy, but it's so much more linear to say, okay, you're going to need to take you know, this shiitake mushroom extract, and you're going to need to do this. And I want you to exercise, you know, 10 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes after, whatever. It's a lot harder conversation to say, how does it hitting you that you have this cancer diagnosis, and how are you processing that? Or is anyone helping you? Have you heard that you can process it? That's something that is largely left out, unless the person's already working with somebody where they're, you know, they're doing processing of some kind. The reason I think that's so critical and foundational is the first thought most humans have when they hear cancer. And I wrote the book either as the loved one, caregiver, or the patient, because you both go through similar problems. The first thing you hear, whether it's your loved one or you, and you have cancer, is, am I going to die? You know, or I'm going to die, depending on where your brain goes. Because many people do, many people don't also, but that's the first thing. Then the next thing is you actually start to have a very similar process to grieving, the stages of grief. You know, so normally you have, you know, the shock, and then you have some denial and anger and bargaining and all those things. And it's not that that's the end all be all, but I use that as a format in the book to tell people, look, you're familiar with these things. We've all had denial. We've all been angry. We've all, you know, whatever. But this is actually sort of a process after watching people and having these discussions about their cancer for all these years. You go through the same process. And the big thing is it's normal and it's okay. And then the next thing is you just don't want to get stuck in the process, because the real magic for your brain and the real magic for your neurobiology and your epigenetic signalers, which actually turn on and off disease signals, that's very important, is not that you just suddenly believe you don't have cancer or something. It's that you realize that you just got some bad news that's horrible. You realize how you feel about it and that you're going to move through this. And the other side of it is, as you move through, you'll find out stuff about yourself that you maybe don't want to know or you haven't dealt with. And that's where I see people usually, it's wherever they kind of get hung up. You know, some people stay in denial. Some people get really angry, whatever. Again, fine. Just you got to find a way to move past that, because that's probably connected to, you know, whatever else. So that's the brain part, really. And your brain is that potent. I have, you know, the reason that I didn't stop at food and muscle, the physical, you know, more concrete parts, was I have literally seen people where their outlook in the face of the worst metastatic cancers kept them alive much longer, and their quality of life was so much better. And their ability to actually affect other people was a positive ability. You don't see that with a lot of people who are facing the end of life. So it's that sort of thing that, you know, I started to see that power. And then I said, well, where do humans get stuck? And so that book is really about, here's the normal process. Everyone does it a little bit different, but you first normalize it. Second, no, it's okay to be upset. It's okay to be whatever, but this is about turning that from being a victim to being an empowered person around a disease. Nobody wants it. Okay. We'll all agree on that. But if this is the, you know, the cards I have, I can be empowered, and I can be in, you know, I can be the empowered member of it, you know, mentally, emotionally, and that does affect your healing.
It absolutely does. And what are some of the daily rituals or practices that you encourage your patients to try out that can strengthen this mental muscle and the resiliency to know, again, that your diagnosis is not necessarily a life sentence, and you can still experience joy even if ultimately the diagnosis does lead to the end of life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the first things is that as a hard discussion. You know, and one of my colleagues who's actually still practicing at 85 years old has that discussion the first time he meets with a patient and says, you know, we're all going to die. We're human. You happen to have a diagnosis that may make that sooner or not, but that's all it is. Mm-hmm. And so what we do around that, you have to reframe where that is in your mind. So one of the things that I've seen, and it really goes back to if you're working on anything, you know, you're working through issues in a relationship or whatever, you find out that there's blocks to getting to resolution. It's the same process with people. So a lot of the same things that are helpful that most of us humans don't want to do. One is just being honest, normalizing, but also keeping track, like journaling. It's very useful. Journaling, you know, is a way to say, boy, today I was so angry. I don't deserve this. I don't, you know, whatever, fill in the blank. And being able to say that, it's okay to say that, you know, or today I was, you know, very sad. You know, I feel a loss. I feel, you know, whatever. So journaling is sort of a way to keep score, to keep track, and also to go back and say, gee, I've actually made some progress here. The other thing I think that, you know, and journaling is not the most important, it's just the first thing that came about my mind. But one of the things I think is important about journaling is it can also tell you where you might be reaching a point where you might need someone to bounce some things off of. If you can't get past your feelings of, you know, sadness or denial or anger or whatever, it can be real helpful to have somebody from the outside just help you process through that, you know. And a lot of people think, well, then I'm saying I should be happy about my cancer. No, that's not what it is. Those are not healing emotions to stay in. They're fine to have go. The other thing that I put in a lump, because everyone has different personal views and feelings about this, and I, there's no way to say these without upsetting somebody, but I believe I found the least offensive way to talk about it. Whether you want to call it mindfulness or prayer or meditation or just being thoughtful and centered or some combination of those, that area, in my personal opinion, has to be dealt with while you're going through. Because what tends to stop us from moving forward and being an empowered person are things we don't know consciously about often. And they will just hold us at a certain place and we'll feel like we can't get past it or whatever. And a lot of times, whatever way you practice that, whether and you know, for people who like a lot of science and research, the mindfulness research is giant now, you know, and that's great. You know, there's research on meditation, there's research on prayer, there's all this stuff. So whatever works for you in that respect, but you know, it all goes back to, you know, whereas journaling is sort of externalizing and logging what's going on. And sometimes as you journal, things come out that you weren't imagining would come out. This is sort of calming all of that external stuff and saying, today, what can I do about what's, you know, here at the core? So I think those two things are very, very core to the process. The next is just being informed, knowing it's okay that these things come up, because a lot of people get angry and they're, you know, we're social, many of us are socialized not to get angry or whatever, and they don't realize that's normal, you know, and it's, you don't want to stay angry, but I mean, that's you processing. If you ignore part of the process, you usually can't get past it, and you can't really be empowered until you've at least looked at these stages of you processing your grief about your diagnosis, your grief about loss of maybe some physical function or whatever it is. You can't get to being empowered and having a better view of that until you really are honest about it and you go through it. So education about that's a process too, and it's okay. And here's some steps to get through it. Those are the big things, I think. And then, you know, if you need help, definitely. Most of us are not living in a vacuum, so we usually have loved ones, family, partners, somebody who's kind of our core, might be a little group or one per whatever. They're going through the same thing, so they, you know, they need to sort of buy into, you know, working through it with you. And I, you know, the other thing that we already mentioned is, we forget, especially now where there's so much, like you can be on some form of media 24/7 all the time. And a lot of it is great and a lot of it is really poison. And one of the things I talk about in the second book are poisoned influences. And it's, we're not trying to do it, but, you know, would you go and, you know, let's say there was some really great treatment that was 90%, you know, remission rate. When you went for the treatment, would you say, I'm only going to take 10% of the treatment and I want to throw the rest away? Well, you know, by inviting a lot of poison in mentally and emotionally, that's kind of what you're doing. And some people are aware of it. A lot of people just don't realize how much they have coming in. That's just, it's not signals you need.
Mm-hmm. And I would also think that just poisoning ourselves physically with continuing to increase our exposome, where we're constantly being exposed to endocrine disruptors and carcinogens in the food and our environment, it's all very poisonous and very, very toxic.
Yeah. I mean, the world we live in now, we can't escape it. And it's worse than it was even 50 years ago. Certainly 75 years ago or 100 years ago. And so that's a lot of the basics about, you know, whether it's, you know, as we said, food, that's the biggest way that bad stuff gets into us is all the toxic things and all that. You know, and then there's also things that we do that can enhance just getting rid of junk too. So, you know, traditional things like staying hydrated, which most people think they do and they don't. Very ancient ideas, you know, like if it is okay for you physically, sweating is really, really good for us, you know, keeping our digestive tract working and, you know, all the limitatory things our body tries really hard, even in a, you know, toxic modern world. But yeah, you know, one of the things with just as an example, we would treat, and this has been a really great positive thing since what I call the old days. Now that patients are more educated and informed, we now get people who will come in and say, I had stage 1 or 2 breast cancer, prostate cancer, maybe a colon cancer they caught early, something like that. And the doctor says they think they got it and we have no evidence of disease. There's no more treatment because, you know, it was a low stage and they believe that I'm at no evidence of disease remission. That's great. I asked the oncologist, what do I do next? And they said, well, come back every, you know, 6 months or every year for us to screen you. Or if you get symptoms of cancer, come back. Well, can I do anything else? Well, come back if you get cancer. So now patients are actually saying, well, I believe there's more, you know, I could do. And again, that's just not their world to, you know, do this. So we started doing a lot of, and this is just, it's so rewarding, you know, because mostly we work with stage 4 people who are dying for so many decades. Now we got people who were doing what we call secondary prevention where, okay, I had cancer, but I either got it in remission or no evidence of disease. So we're going to take that as good news. What do I do so it doesn't come back? Well, what we work on with those folks a lot is not so much the cancer focus. It's trying to go through and say, okay, do you have a lot of endocrine disrupting chemicals coming into your life? And people think maybe that's like some kind of far out, you know, sideline science. That's actually a thing in the endocrine world, in the world of the endocrine specialty. They have publications just on that because it's such a big problem. But they don't know how to deal with it. So a lot of what we do is we look at, number one, do you have any hormones left after your cancer treatment, which is a big problem because those run our body. So we don't want them all to be gone. Number two is, do you have a lot of stuff in your body that maybe you shouldn't have? A third one that's huge and can trigger more cancer, more immune problems. A lot of times after cancer therapy, our immune system was suppressed long enough, we might have picked up some chronic infectious things that for a healthy person aren't a problem, but with my suppressed immune system maybe in there just churning away, creating a lot of negative immune response. And those are actually kind of like endocrine disrupting chemicals or out of balance hormones. Those are associated with further cancers later on. So yeah, let's clear the slate. Let's rejoice that you're in remission and then let's really clean stuff up. And now, you know, what you can tell people is if you didn't get the first cancer, we call it primary prevention. You do all the same stuff, you know.
Exactly.
And it doesn't guarantee, you know, you won't get cancer, it won't come back. But why not take away as many footholds as this thing called cancer, you know, can possibly have? Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not just about the physical journey, it's also about that mental journey. And it's also about the belief that we don't have to be afflicted with cancer at some point in our life and making small decisions day after day. I have one more, and I'm sure it's a very loaded question. You know, a lot of the times when I talk to physicians and I talk to pharmacists and I talk to naturopaths and everybody is basically saying the same thing, you know, eat real food, mostly plants, not too much, exercise enough, but not too much, have positive thoughts, have this, have that. It's all kind of the same message. Do you believe that there is truly a root cause for all cancers out there that we can address? Now, the solution, of course, is multifactorial. But if you're really going to get down to, like, is there one main thing that is making us sick chronically with cancers and diabetes and hypertension and hyperlipidemia and anxiety and depression and all of the things? And if there is, what is it?
Yeah, I definitely get where you're going. And I would agree that, you know, I mean, unless someone's really way out there, the basic advice does come down to those things, because what those things all do, whether it's in the world of the food or the brain or the muscle stuff and all that, what they really are doing is changing the epigenetic signals that go into your body. So your genes are a code, and unless something's gone wrong, they're usually in the proper order, et cetera. But it's not so much the genes. Now, there's obviously genetic diseases, but for most of us, health and disease is the stuff around the genes that turn on and off the right or the wrong signals. Well, things like not having a lot of toxic chemicals in your world, all the stuff we talked about, those really are trying to make positive epigenetic signaling changes so your genome can stay in a healthy frame. I always bring this up because one area, you know, sadly, that's both increasing and that I've dealt with a lot is children with cancer. And there's always exceptions where I've had many pediatric cancer patients who are born with their cancer. There's nothing they did, you know, like this.
But it still is what they were exposed to. It's the exposure.
There's something from before.
Mom and ancestry, all of it.
There's a percentage, a small percent, single digit percent, where there are genetic, not epigenetic, but actual genetic triggers that get turned on that will create cancer. So there's those, okay? But everything else, yes, are things that would affect the epigenome. And when I'm trying to teach students about the epigenome, I essentially say, look at the entire history that's happened to you and at least a few generations before you. And those are all the signals that your genome is now trying to sort out, right? You don't have control over what grandma did, although it does affect you, but you do have control over these other things, you know. And even with that, there are people where we still never unraveled where did it go off the rails. You know, you get a 19-year-old with a type of cancer that there's seven of in the entire of North America, you know, and it's and they don't have any of these reasons. But I think if you take the big bulk, it goes back to, yes, the treatments are multifactorial. Epigenetic signals are very multifactorial. So, you know, for some people, exposure to toxic things is poison because of certain things in their genome. Other people, it's much less of an issue. But for those same people, having their hormones out of balance might be a huge problem, or, you know, having their having their dietary intake be out of balance could be a huge problem. So we all kind of have our own Achilles areas, but they all do tend to relate back to anything that can affect your epigenome, including up here, you know, what you think and how you're doing. I think that's where much cancer starts.
So fascinating. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for being here with us today. Listeners, Dr. Anderson's new book is Cancer, The Journey from Diagnosis to Empowerment. He also has another book called Outside the Box, Cancer Therapies. I so appreciate getting to speak with you today. Thank you so much for coming and being a guest on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Kelsey Lorman. Production design, sound design, and editing is by Jive Media. If you have a question about this or any other episode of the podcast, send us an email to hello@lindsayelmoreshow.com. And hey, since you're still here, take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. And while you're at it, go over and follow us on Instagram @LindsayElmoreShow. This helps us bring the pod to more people.